Yes, you're here.
Please, the court, my name is Patrick Bynum, and I represent the appellant, Lewis Chester Lee. And we are here on basically two issues. One is the...
Would you care to reserve time for rebuttal?
No, Judge.
Very well, thank you, yes, sir.
Hopefully I'll be brief.
All right, fine.
We're on two issues. Number one is about the appellant's assertion that the lower court did not, basically sufficiency of the evidence. And the second one is the request by the court to give our thoughts on whether or not the written statement of facts that was presented complies Rule 5A:8. I apologize if I lose my voice, Judge. I'm battling with the elements. So, if the court pleases, I'll go to the case in chief, and I'll comment on the issue of the written statement of facts. This is an issue. The statement of facts in this case is very simple. There was a protective order entered against my client, and the basis of the protective order was differences between my client and the mother of his child. And the protective order basically said that he was not to directly have contact with the alleged victim in this case, Ms. Ellis. Could not come within 1,000 feet, and he could not deliver the child directly to the mother. On the day in question was October 20, 2013, and basically Ms. Ellis arrived in the parking lot of a shopping center in the town of Ashland. The child was delivered by an older child to her car. She did not see the defendant at that point. Upon exiting the shopping center, all of a sudden, Mr. Ellis, according to Ms. Ellis,
excuse me, said, counsel, may I ask you two questions?
Yes, ma'am.
In this case, in order to sustain your position on this issue, assignment of error that you've raised, would we have to find either that the witness's testimony was incredible, inherently incredible as a matter of law, and or is the issue that accepting her testimony in its totality as credible, it's insufficient?
Judge, we would argue that her testimony is incredible.
As a matter of law?
Yes, yes, ma'am.
And why?
For various reasons. Number one, there was no independent witnesses here. It's basically her word against her, against my
Why does that make her testimony incredible as a matter of law? Don't we always have, not always, usually have competing witnesses, perhaps one for the defendant, one for the Commonwealth, and if the trial court accepts the one witness, yeah, that's adequate?
But the bottom line, Your Honor, is that she had, in my opinion, she had motivation to testify untruthfully. And the reason for that is, number one, as I said, no independent witnesses. Number two, she did not, the offense date occurred on October 20, 2013, according to her. On cross-examination, she could not remember the exact date, and she equivocated quite a bit, especially on cross-examination. And in addition to that, she waited almost 2 months to get the warrant itself. Thirdly, she never saw the defendant within the parking lot, and the only time that she actually saw him, according to her testimony, was when they were exiting the shopping center, and he happened to be in front of her waiting for the stoplight to turn green so that he could exit, and she was right behind
him. Counsel, he was in the same car that she saw drop the child off.
That's her testimony, and I understand the court, and we disputed that, and it goes to the another reason that we set aside in the brief was the number one of the other issues was that my client vehemently denied that he was there at all, period, and that was not challenged by the Commonwealth. I mean, she was not able to impeach his testimony. He denied he was there at all. And
her testimony, though, was that he was there at the intersection and made the form of a gun with his fingers, and that was the part that violated the protective order, wasn't that communication?
Well, that plus the fact that she alleged he was in the parking lot of the shopping center also. We said we weren't there, period.
Well, counsel, but that was not the conclusion of the trier of fact.
I understand that. I understand that perfectly.
So yeah. Let's go back to how the victim was inherently incredible. I mean, it's a very high standard, and you're suggesting that she was inherently incredible, okay. And you're basing that on you're basing it on your client's testimony, the fact that there were other instances where she had claimed violation of the protective order, and what else?
Well, the fact that she was not able to put him in the shopping center, other than the fact what she said when they were exiting the shopping center at the stoplight, and the court previously alluded to the fact that there were other instances, and to me that is very important. This case came on in Hanover County. Prior to this particular case, she had the same type of charge in Caroline County, which was dismissed. Before this case came on, there was also another case in Henrico County that they had continued from to go past this particular trial date. So you have three instances by the same person alleging the same thing, and she didn't deny that in the court below. And as a result of that, my conclusion is, and we're requesting the court to conclude, that her testimony is suspect. There was bad faith, bad blood, and there was animosity between these folks, regardless of any other testimony. She had a reason, in my opinion, to fabricate the facts. And she was not supported by anything other than what she said happened.
Wouldn't the facts in this case, though, be equally supportive of that your client was breaking this protective order repeatedly?
You can draw that conclusion, yes, sir. I can't deny that. Obviously, I'm taking the opposite position. But certainly, you can certainly take that position. But that is the sum and substance of the argument on the case in chief. In reference to the written statement of facts, I'll tell the court that obviously this was a misdemeanor, and the case was not, there was no record, so we had to go to the written statement of facts. In this particular case, the written statement of facts was prepared by my office, submitted to the Commonwealth Attorney for their approval. They did. There were some minor changes, and it was submitted to the court within the time frame set out by the rules. And we made all the timely filings. The court, and I cannot and I will not comment on why, but the court stamped rather than signed the written statement of facts, seen, dated, and the court initialed it. And we're getting into Rule 5A:8C, and the issue is whether that was a proper procedure, whether the written statement of facts are properly before the court. I would suggest to the court that from a practical standpoint, you have the record that came up, and the whole record came up, including the written statement of facts. So the court has the entire record in front of it, and it's a question of whether or not the circuit court should have signed, approved, or made some other statement. And I would suggest implicit in the court's initials would be that he reviewed the written statement of facts, had been signed off on by both counsel, seen and agreed, and I think that implies that he approved it. And I think there's been substantial compliance with the rule. The court had signed, seen, and approved with the, but that didn't happen. But I think you got a situation where you have the entire record is before the court, and I would suggest to the court that the written statement of fact is accurate, and he did approve it. Maybe not with the full signature, but you have that stamp.
Counsel, let me just ask you a question about the stamp. So the stamp says seen.
Yes, ma'am.
And I think that's a little bit more problematic than if it were, you know, under contract law, there's an argument that the initials are sufficient to constitute a signature. But talk to us a little bit about the seen.
Judge, the only thing that I can determine from that, and that goes to implication, the fact is that the court, and I'm certainly not going to try to get into the court's mind, but that implies to me, and I'm implying, asking the court to make the same implication, that he looked at the written statement of facts, it was approved and agreed to by counsel, there's no objection by counsel, and I'm assuming that the court in its mind said we will, it appears everybody has agreed and there we are, and I'm going to, and that's about is, I have no real insight other than that.
Are you familiar with the Parker decision?
I am, Judge.
Doesn't that cover it, that the initials are the equivalent in this circumstance to a signature?
Yes, it does. And I cited that in my brief. But that's the basis. And I will inquire with the court afterwards why that happened.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Baumgartner.
Good afternoon. Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. Addressing first the procedural issue, Your Honors, and the issue of whether seen is sufficient. Rule 5A8C requires only that the statement be signed by the trial judge. It doesn't, and then filed with the court. It doesn't require the judge to mark it, agreed upon, approved, anything like that. And therefore, we would suggest that the initials themselves function as that signature, and as we know from it being part of the record, the statement of facts was then filed with the clerk's office. If anything, the seen specifies that it actually was reviewed by the trial judge. It wasn't merely marked received. It was reviewed by the trial judge before it was filed, and therefore we think the statement of facts is properly filed to bring this matter before the court.
So to see something is to approve it?
I think to see something means you've reviewed it. And then the initials and the fact that it was actually filed show that it was approved, because the rule requires it to be signed and then filed. And so it was marked seen, so it was reviewed. The initials satisfy the filing, and then it was actually, or the initials satisfy the signature, then it was actually filed by the court. As opposed to frequently offices have a stamp say, you know, received and a date. This actually shows that it was reviewed by the court. And because this was an agreed upon statement of facts, the court was perfectly within its rights to sign it forthwith. Regarding the insufficiency of evidence, the evidence was sufficient to show that he willfully disobeyed the protective order in multiple ways. It established that he returned the child to the parking lot. He may have insisted that it didn't happen on October 20th. However, he testified that he routinely delivered the child to that parking lot. And the court took judicial notice of the fact that parking lot was not 1,000 feet in
Counsel,
size.
Counsel, I wanted to ask a question about that.
Yes.
One of the issues in the case was, in fact, whether or not the appellant, if he was present, he was within 1,000 feet. I believe the witness said so, but as the statement of facts said, the trial court took some judicial notice here. He was opined that he was familiar with the shopping center in question and found that due to the size of the shopping center, any position the defendant occupied within the shopping center was within 1,000 feet of Ellis's location in front of Martin's supermarket. Statement of facts doesn't indicate that there was any objection to the fact that the trial court took that judicial notice. So it's a non-issue.
That's correct. I think the only objection to that is the defense argument that maybe he wasn't in the vehicle, but I don't think that's a reasonable inference from this. the mother saw her child being brought from the vehicle, and then a few minutes later, while still within the parking lot before exiting it, saw the defendant in that same vehicle in front of her.
Additional curiosity question,
yes.
And maybe my memory about the record is deficient in this regard, but the order that permitted visitation and delivery of the child, was it an order that permitted or required delivery of the child to the mother at this shopping center?
It didn't require delivery at this shopping center. It did require delivery through a third party.
Through a third party?
Yes. It was very specific that even when discussing the child, the discussions had to go through a third party. The communication had to be done through a third party. And so arguably, I would say that the defendant merely bringing this child to the Martin's parking lot certainly violated that order in that it necessarily placed him within 1,000 feet of the victim. Additionally, he violated the no contact provision. He pointed his fingers at her, mimed shooting at her. That obviously was an intentional piercing of the protective barrier fashioned by the protective order. And also, in a third way, he violated it by threatening her with that action, was committing an act of family abuse. So he didn't threaten it only by being within 1,000 feet of her, also by miming shooting her. He threatened it in additional ways. And she simply isn't incredible. As a matter of law, Your Honors, I would submit to you this is a pretty routine domestic violence situation and routine domestic violence evidence. She had an order of protection against him that was granted by the court. She had filed multiple violations of it. And whether or not a prior violation had been dismissed, we have no evidence of why it was dismissed. And the fact that certain violations of an order of protection are dismissed is not contrary to human experience that this violation did occur. There's no real motive to lie established here. And the court made all credibility determinations in this, and they simply didn't believe the defendant, they believed the victim. Therefore, we urge you to affirm.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Bynum?
No, Judge.
All right, thank you. We'll take a moment and come down and greet counsel and then